Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Canis Albinus.
Makalua.
The main team.
Mega Bears fan.
Okay, phone. You get out of here.
All right, well, welcome, Internet, to Polycast, episode 438. I am Mega Bears fan, joined, as always, by our regular hosts, Canis Albinus.
So much stuff. I'm buried.
Oh, yes, we all are, as well as Makalua.
This is too much information all at once. The Mackie processing unit is slowing down. Spinny thing.
And also suffering from brain overload is the Mian team.
Paid and paying in exposure.
Oh dear.
What kind of exposure? Well, we'll see.
Don't get us banned, please.
Oh, well, that probably won't happen. At least not today.
I think we're going to have to try a lot harder for that.
Well, I don't think it'd be that hard. I think of some things to say or some video footage we could show that would pretty well immediately solve that task.
Please, no.
But,
all right.
Yeah, it's not a good idea, but it's an idea.
Here we go. The news you've all been waiting for, more than even the most information about Civ 7 ever, the best news that we could have ever heard. Ding dong, the launcher's dead.
Ah, yes.
Yay!
All right, folks, that's a wrap. There's nothing else important to talk about today. See you all next week.
The riggedy wrecked launcher.
That was confusing the first time after they patched it out and I launched it and it asked me what mode I wanted to run Civ 7. Huh. Civ 6 in, because it was asking for the DX version. I was like, why is it asking that? And then I realized, because I had done like a lot of people and did the thing that made the launcher shut up, you know, skip through the launcher. So I had noticed that was the launcher thing, and I had to be told that. I was like, oh.
Yeah, now everybody who had like hacks or whatever or mods to disable the launcher, are all their games going to break now?
I don't think so.
Just a command line thingy.
But yeah, I had to do like several double takes and like look for sources and make sure that this was coming from like an actual Firaxis source, because I was like, no, that sounds too good to be true. I saw it on Reddit and I'm like, who is this user? I'm like, wait a minute, is this like an actual Firaxis person? Like, is this for real? Like, this was super surprising because it seems like every video game developer, especially PC developer, are just like all in on launchers. Like, it's like, wow, like they're going to start removing them now. I wonder if more publishers are going to start doing this too.
But we did hear, I mean,
well, you already have a launcher, you just don't need a second one.
We did hear from what's his name at Gearbox, who was lamenting the fact that even though he bet all his money on the Epic Games Store, it didn't help, so he's back on Steam and he's like, well, I wish there wasn't a Steam, but I guess there is. And you know, because Steam is the ultimate launcher, we don't need another one.
To be fair,
you like,
I've got some mileage
out
of Epic.
I mean, I was, the cynic in me was expecting things would get even worse, that we would have Steam and then a publisher launcher, and then like the friggin' development studios would have their own launcher after the publisher launcher. Like, I thought it would get worse before it got better, so this was good news.
Yeah, that's the way to go. You can have like five launchers in a chain, and you can't play the game until you've like launched each launcher.
That's right. You have to open Steam to launch the 2K launcher, and then use the 2K launcher to launch the Firaxis launcher, and then use the Firaxis launcher to launch the Civ. But no, that's not the case. Now
that's to launch the Civ launcher, which then can launch Civ.
You were describing my idea of hell. Let's move on.
I mean, that would make the games very high level in a sense.
It's like fighting a Dark Souls boss just to get into the actual game.
Dark Souls bosses are easier than that.
Mostly are.
Mackie.
I know, I'm trying to find my thing. I've lost the thread. I lost the plot while I was at it.
Don't worry, I've got some plots I can show you.
Your plots mostly involve how much overkill do I need.
Go for the civilization.2k
one. You want the exactly correct amount of kill. You don't want to overkill. That's silly. You silly.
I had some sort of a transition about not moving on or something like that, because that's technically what we're doing with the challenge of the month. Basically, we're going back through the same challenges of the month again, but in a shorter cycle. They are rotating. They are doing a rotating redo first for, I think we've already missed 7C.
Yeah, 7C has already happened, yeah.
Yeah, the Robot Revolution one is going on right now. It's recording, then it will be 3 stars each, and then Reach for the Heavens, all just a week apart. Yeah. Don't know what they're going to do after that, but...
Then it'll be Challenge 11, whatever that'll be.
Okay. Well, I don't know, I mean, this kind of feels like it might be like a grand finale kind of thing. I'm wondering if there are any more challenges after this.
I have to think there will be, because it's not that hard to make these.
Yeah, Redux, the next challenges.
They just also know right now during the month of August, all we're going to be in through the next couple of weeks is our brains are all Civ 7, Civ 7, Civ 7, Civ 7.
Well, but then at the same time, that might bring people back to wanting to play Civ 6 and, you know, maybe having fresh content available for them.
Yeah, and there's plenty of people who didn't get a chance to with some of these when they were originally released. So this is a second chance as well, which is not bad.
Well, I think it would be nice if they would just like add them as like scenarios or whatever to the game to play at any time for anybody who didn't get to play them during their, you know, timed launches.
Yeah, since the whole point of playing these was supposedly to get a cool badge on your, what's it called? Hall of Fame. The problem is if you're playing on more than one PC, those badges don't migrate between PCs. So if you play them all on one PC and then you have to reinstall it 10 years later, you don't have those badges anymore.
Unless you actually go to the trouble of like copying or backing up your Hall of Fame file off of the one PC and moving it between your PCs and saving it somewhere safe for later.
Well, yeah, it would be easy to do since it already uses cloud saves, I think, but it doesn't actually save those, which is pretty stupid if they're going to make the whole focus, hey, get these cool badges.
Yeah, here's a little feature suggestion for Civ 7. Like, have like a dedicated cloud save slot for your Hall of Fame so that it is on all of your installations across all PCs and will be there when you load up, when you install it on a new computer, you know, sometime in the future and play it again 5 years down the road.
Yeah. But there are new features associated with these Reduxes. I won't go over 7Cs because it's already over, but these challenges are now available on deity level for the challenge. And they have new parameters for the Redux. So for the current one, which is Robot Revolution, the civilian units except settlers and builders are all disabled. Barbarian use of their AI, or barbarian AI use of great giant death robots is better, so they don't just walk around doing nothing. There's no longer any score from civics, tech, or religions. The World Congress is also disabled. So the only time I played the Robot Revolution one, I lost to Australia by score victory because the GDRs never attacked me. So that sounds like that this Redux makes it harder. For the 3 stars each challenge, which is August 28th to September 4th, the Redux parameters are Babylon's unique Eureka ability applies to civics as well as science, but science and culture yield per population is decreased by 99%. So it's basically you do Eurekas and civics, or for science and such, or else you get no science and no culture. Reach for the Heaven decided that their options are there's no bonus resources on the map. The map is switched to an arid map. And military units beyond warrior and spearmen cannot be trained. So no more conquering your way into victory on that one.
Lame.
Well, you're supposed to win a culture victory anyway, so.
Yeah, and the best way to spread your culture is with blood.
And then I like how there's a note at the end of this that also says the launcher is going away.
Yeah.
Also, what we forgot to point out, they also told us at that point, we've seen elsewhere, the 2K launcher will not be implemented in Civ 7.
But you will have to have a 2K account to do online play.
Still better than a launcher.
Oh, no.
Yep.
Well, I mean, and you're getting, like, free stuff for syncing up to that online account, too. So I don't think they'll have too much trouble getting people to do that.
Yay. Only cost your soul.
Yay, free account data stolen.
Yeah, pretty much.
Oh, well, it's not like all of our social security numbers aren't already stolen anyway, so.
Plus, they're probably doing that regardless of whether you're signing up for these accounts or not.
Well, I signed up for the Scout Cat and Julius Caesar, so it doesn't matter. And now, for the moment you've actually been waiting for, Civ 7 got all its release stuff this week.
Well, All the release stuff is maybe a little bit.
Okay, not all the release
stuff.
We
have way more information than previously, for sure.
The gameplay reveal.
Yeah, and my entire YouTube homepage is a wall of content creators saying, I have played Civ 7.
Yeah, mine is way more varied, but I've seen plenty of that myself.
I also want to play Civ 7, but I haven't yet.
Well, apparently they invited a bunch of creators to Baltimore, paid for them to get there, and put them up in hotels. Apparently very nice hotels from part of the discussions I've heard on a couple of them. But,
it wasn't just YouTube creators. There were
Twitch creators, all sorts of creators.
And there were
creators everywhere.
And all the media institutions sent people as well. Mm-hmm. And at least some of the Civ 5 multiplayer people were there. It was a pretty big open house. So there are a lot of information that has been released from multiple sources in multiple languages. We are not going to go through specifically each article on its own, because that would take forever and would probably be a lot of rehashing. So what we're going to do is go through the various things that have been added to the game or changed in the game based on what we think people are most interested in and our reactions to them.
First things first, ages. I have gained more ages. But so has Civ 7. We kind of had ages already, so it's like sort of new, because there's a lot more mechanical depth going on with ages than previously. Like you have like actually different systems between ages, and you pick new civs between ages, which is going to be pretty hot button apparently.
Yes,
but I mean we had ages before, but now we really have ages.
Ed Beach made a point of specifically saying that this is not the same as the old eras.
Right, from Civ 6.
I mean, there's some similar basis for the conceptual divide between when they happen.
Yeah.
But this is definitely very different.
I wonder if each age is further divided into eras.
It does not look like it.
Yeah, from the gameplay stuff I've seen and what the creators have been talking about, no, but it does cover really big swath of the game. Like, it's almost, each age is almost a little game of Civ into itself.
I
wonder, because, like, you, unless you get golden ages for some buildings, like, when you enter a new age, you lose effects of some of the older buildings, and that will impact a player's choice on whether buildings are worth making. But maybe they'll just make the building so much stronger that they're worth making for short term.
Well, also to Mackie's point, like, there are victory conditions for each age. So, like, they are just, like, kind of their own little game.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the selling points is that you could play one on its own or an entire campaign with each of them. And I guess that implies that you can start in various ages, which, I mean, you could start at different times in Civ as well, I guess.
Yeah, which, like, again, isn't totally foreign to Civ. I mean, we've had advanced starts since, at least Civ 4. Did Civ 3 have advanced starts?
I don't remember.
I did not play Civ 3.
But yeah, we've advanced starts have been available in some capacity for quite a long time.
They're going to make them come up into sort of, instead of it just you hitting end turn and you flip into a new age, oh, you're in a golden age, here, pick a nice shiny bonus advantage. There's going to be this whole accumulation, big grand finale to the age, as opposed to just, you know, next turn.
Considering how impactful that looks like it will be, I hope it's a bit more consistently available than Golden Ages from Civ 6. Because especially if you play with, like, slightly different settings in Civ 6, like turning off barbs, it can be really challenging then to hit a Golden Age as a consequence of doing that. in the game.
Yeah, we didn't get to see, I don't think we got to see much of that transition except for one screen showing that you were going to be able to select some bonuses that you accumulate.
I mean, that's going to be true for a lot of the stuff we're covering today. It's not like they went into the weeds of the specifics of how each of these new features work in a way that you could use it as a guide to play at an advanced level in a couple months. Certainly not.
No.
So I'm saying this as a hope. I have no idea how they're going to tune ages. That tuning might not be done yet. Probably isn't, because balance changes happen even after the game is released. So
yeah, they need to get more outside people on it instead of just their own internal and external, you know.
Yeah.
Bigger pool of people at it to see if it's balanced or not.
And even all the content creators who like went to this event, the ones I listened to said they were basically only able to play the first age. So even they like yes. still kind of have no clue how this works like further on down the stretch. They didn't get to play a whole game up through the modern era. They just played the, what are they calling it? The antiquity age?
Yeah. Age of Antiquity. Yeah.
Yeah. The vast majority of content that. We've seen is that.
Yeah. They wanted to get a feel for the first initial gameplay loop and start getting feedback. And from what all the creators I've watched, they seem to be very serious about listening to the feedback. So,
yeah, but that's tough because you get basically all kinds of feedback from players. And some of it's useful. Some of it makes the game worse. And part of what makes a dev is being able to distinguish like what's useful feedback that could make the game better versus feedback that's just people complaining about something because they don't understand the game or... if they're not at a level to evaluate the trade-offs effectively yet, or they just don't like it because it's not the same as what they remember from previous games, etc. That's not easy to do. I don't care who you are, that's not easy to do.
Yeah, I feel like Firaxis has always been one of the better studios about doing that sort of thing, about listening to feedback and you know, executing on changes based on that feedback pretty well.
Yeah, I think they've been reasonable at it. I give them some pluses and some negatives in that department. But again, it's hard. So, like, I'm not going to criticize them too much because, you know, I don't think I could do it perfectly. I don't think anyone could do it perfectly.
Game development yeah. is one of the hardest things you can do. So, It's always difficult.
Hardest the things, other huh? I don't want to go that far, but it is hard.
To get it all perfectly balanced, it is.
Yeah, you know, we learned that the other two are the Age of Exploration and the Modern Age, but also that the map is literally going to get bigger with each age, which is interesting. I guess it's an idea of how, like, in the Roman era, the whole known world was basically the area around the Mediterranean. Maybe they knew of the That's existence of China. Well, you know, but when you saw a map,
yeah, I mean, them, they the mapped stuff they world, could like they cared about, but they certainly had contact.
Yeah, but that's where their focus was. They knew stuff was outside of it, but their focus was that area around them. And this is what it seems like it is for antiquity. It's you in that area close to you, when you go into the Age of Exploration, it's going to be like in real life where they just went, well, we heard there's this other continent. Let's go see if it's real, you know?
Yeah, I remember, I think, Ed Beach making a comment about that, and I wasn't quite sure how literally or metaphorically to take it. Like, does the map literally have more tiles on it in the later ages, or is it just a case of, oh, you're on one continent in the Antiquity Age, and you have no way to cross the ocean, so the map figuratively gets bigger, because when you get into the Age of Exploration, well, now you can cross that ocean, in which case, that's not any different than how yeah. it currently works. Right now, there isn't that, like, hard line, right? Because you can tech to, you know, astronomy or whatever and get caravels relatively early, you know, depending on your civ and your starting conditions and stuff like that. But like, this is more like, well, no, you can't do that at all until you've, you know,
yeah, like completed that antiquity. That tech's not even in the antiquity tree.
Yeah. And like, you know, presumably like the Vikings, for instance, would be a Age of Exploration civ and not an antiquity civ. So you're not like getting a unique longboat or something like that, that you can get even earlier. And now you're crossing oceans in like the classical era or whatever.
Another thing I guess they could do is they could just define areas for the civs that they can't explore past yet.
Yeah.
And then I guess maybe procedurally generate new civs on new era.
I mean, yeah, it could be that it could literally be that you're playing in the Antiquity Age, you're playing like on one map that's, you know, the equivalent of like Europe and Asia or whatever. And then you get to the Exploration Age and the game literally adds a whole new continent at that point with new players who weren't in the game previously. I mean, that could be what's happening too, in which case, like, that's a huge dramatic change.
It seems like it might be like that, because the little bit I've heard about multiplayer is you don't start with as many players in the first era. Like if you wanted the full complement of how many people you could have, you might have to start in a later era. So that may be mechanically how it's actually being handled.
Interesting.
I think, or I'm pretty sure they mentioned that it was minor civs and such that would be added to the map, not major civs.
Mm.
But who knows? We don't really know for sure.
We don't know.
Well, they also mentioned that these minor people slash civs could develop more so than the rigid settings they had for city-states in the previous two games.
And I also want to say, speaking of those independent civs, one of my favorite things from these previews is that one of, I think it was the official reveal from Firaxis just flat out said that these independent civilizations completely replace both barbarians and city-states. So, you know, I've been on this soapbox for quite a while now about how I would like for civilization to just get rid of the concept of barbarians entirely and not have groups of people who it, you know, dehumanizes in that sort of way. And it looks like that's exactly the way they're going. So I'm very happy about that. The barbarian clans in Civ 6 was a good first step. So it looks like this is just a further expansion of that idea.
And now we get new barbarians. Mindworms.
Oh, no.
That's only in the modern era, probably with a crisis.
Yeah, earlier we can have like super animals like we had in Civ 4. The freaking bears equal to an army of archers.
The dinosaurs show back up again.
But yeah, so since
That's
I guess
true,
we just
take them today.
Since we just brought that up, I guess we can talk about crises, which is the next major bullet point. So each age, I guess, is going to be punctuated by some kind of crisis event. So I guess this is going to be the civilization equivalent of, like, a boss fight? Basically... Yeah,
I don't remember if it was speculation or if somebody actually got mentioned somewhere, but, like, this for the end of antiquity, the sea people. Because suddenly, from nowhere, people were attacking from the ocean and it was beating some of the more established civilizations. And maybe part of that is you fighting it off.
Well, I remember
you had to, like, pick demerits too, like penalties for your
Civ temporarily. The way that I think I recall Ed Beach explaining it is that he said that it's kind of inspired by the Dark Ages concept in Civ 6, where you have to specifically choose debuffs because this is to, and I don't know if this is for all the crises or if it's just for this one particular crisis that they showcased, which is, you know, basically supposed to be this game's version of like the fall of the Roman Empire. So like you have to, if you're the biggest empire or whatever, I guess you have to pick some kind of destabilizing debuff that, you know, makes your empire harder to manage or start to fall apart or more susceptible to other players or independent nations or something. I think he said something about the independent nations all gang up on you and attack you or something like that. They didn't say a lot of specifics. It was very, you know, broad, big picture kind of things. So,
I mean, I saw stuff in the videos that looked like it would hit your economy pretty hard, like double maintenance for your army.
Oh, yeah, we saw such screenshots and video of some of those policies being selected. But it wasn't clear if like every Civ in the game is doing this or if it's just the biggest ones or, you know,
I
stuff
would
like
hope everyone
if it's like
has to deal with it. Well, one, because that lets everyone experience the content. But two, it's more fair that way.
Yeah,
and since everyone's working together on these to like get through to the next age. Per some of the discussion, it would make sense that everyone has to deal with some bullcrap that also requires you to deal with it to advance.
Yeah, like it's going to scale it depending on whoever's the most ahead, whether it's the human or the AI, hopefully, is the one that's going to get the big hit. And then everybody else is dealing with bigger or lesser, maybe somebody who's really far behind gets a buff event or something like that. You know, to level it so you can't snowball so hard.
Yeah, it might be tiered in the way that, like, the emergencies in Civ 6 were, you know, had those, like, tiered rewards or whatever. But yeah, I guess also every one of these crises, or every one of the ages, I guess, has these different quests, which they're calling legacy paths, which, I guess, unlock a golden age, and can also unlock wonders and other perks. And I guess each age is going to have, like, its own set of these. So the example they gave was, there's like a science path that you can do in the Antiquity Age that unlocks the Great Library. So I don't know if that's like you just get the Great Library by completing this or if it just unlocks it for you to build. It'd be kind of weird building the Great Library in the Exploration Age as a reward for having done something in the Antiquity Age. So I'm guessing like you must be able to build it in the Antiquity Age somehow.
I mean, it could also be like a golden era reward, like it upgrades one of your buildings into the Great Library because you earned the golden age.
Yeah.
Now, rather than that giving you nothing, it gives you a tangible benefit going forward.
Yeah, that was something I was unclear about as well, was when these golden ages happen. Like when I first saw it, like I thought maybe it meant that like you completed these legacies and then you get a golden age for like the whole next age. But I'm guessing you get a golden age for completing that legacy within that age.
Probably,
like,
yeah.
Maybe it's like a 10-turn boost to everything or something like that. Scale to the, of course, game length you've chosen.
Yeah.
Yeah, another reason the crises should probably apply to everyone, in addition to just gameplay, is that like a lot of the major historical crises were not one nation, especially the ones that were not like caused by mismanagement inside one nation. Like something like the Bronze Age collapse was devastating. It was not just like in one area. It was in a huge amount of territory, of to the best we could tell. Similarly with like the plague, that was a crisis, and that was not just affecting like one nation. That affected pretty well everyone. World wars affected pretty well everyone. Even people who didn't participate in the world wars felt consequences of them happening pretty severely.
Yeah, social and economic.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder how many of those sorts of things are going to be modeled in the game, because some of the examples you just cited are things that don't quite fit in to this particular progression path. Like the Bronze Age collapse is something that you would expect would happen fairly early or in the middle of the Antiquity Age, not, you know, at the end of it going into... I'm still also unclear
those
if the Antiquity Age...
though.
Oh yeah, I'm just saying, like, I'm still unclear if the Antiquity Age also includes like medieval, or if medieval is like the start of the Exploration Age.
I feel like medieval makes more sense in the Exploration, but who knows? We'll see.
Yeah,
but I guess my point is, like, you could contrive crises that didn't happen in history that would make sense as historical crises that could happen.
Like, would the world wars be the end of the Exploration Age, or would that be something that happens? Because, I mean, all the units and stuff for that are in the modern age. So clearly the world wars aren't the crisis for the modern age, because that's like the very beginning. I would assume the modern age crisis is going to be things like climate change and stuff like that.
Yeah, maybe. Most likely. I was under the impression that the Antiquities Age ended right around the time that the Medieval Age started. I was assuming that the real world event that precipitated the end of the Antiquities Age in like a Civ game would be the eruptions of the 530s to 550s that we're not quite exactly sure which volcano erupted, but it was so bad that it caused multiple civilizations to have serious problems. It was around the time of the Plague of Justinian.
Yeah, well, and again, I think the crisis that they talked about in like the previews, they compared it to the fall of the Roman Empire. So, like, presumably that's the end of the Antiquity Age. It would be, you know, that would be what, like 300 AD, somewhere in there?
About 500 AD.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on what historic event you consider was the fall of the Roman Empire, but, you know.
Well, it was clearly the fall of Constantinople in 1453, of course.
I would just like to say also that in the game, there's no rule that says that the crisis for the end of any particular era has to be the same between games.
Well, I think they said there's
multiple. Yeah. You could have like a rotating pool.
Yeah.
I think I heard something say that they're like random, maybe. So I don't know.
I would like to see them random, but weighted based on game state. But that might be too much. Maybe they just leave them random.
Yeah, because then people would always manipulate it to get to one particular crisis they knew they could handle easy.
Well, sort of, right? Like, you could have, like, because it's still random. Like, it might be that some crises are only possible based on some conditions, whereas others, like a volcano erupting and screwing with, like, agriculture in everywhere in the known world, is unavoidable. Like, there's nothing you could do in antiquity that would have any reasonable chance of preventing that. Whereas, like, if you're more or less prepared against a military invasion, maybe they lower the weight of that, like, the chances of that being the crises you get. Etc.
It's gonna be. I was gonna say, to be fair, there's very little we could do today if a major eruption caused a problem like that. So.
Oh yeah, I mean, like if like Yellowstone blew, I mean that would be.
That's an end of game crisis.
Yeah, it's overblown. It'd be pretty ugly even now. Yes.
Right, but I mean, if we're talking, I mean, you're talking about
overblown threats. If Krakatoa went off again.
Yeah.
But I mean, I guess my point is certainly if it would be troubled now, like there's no way they could do it back then. And it would be reasonable to leave that event weighted the same regardless of game state. Whereas with others, maybe you could weight it based on what's happening.
But we know that Ed Beach said in an interview that they're working on other types of crises like unrest in your population or plagues or some other systems for crises.
Yeah, and I'm sure there will probably be new ones probably added post-release. So I'm sure there will be a pretty decent variety of those when all is said and done. I do wonder how, like, because it looks like there's also like tracks that progress towards it. So it also looks like you could potentially trigger these prematurely too. And I wonder how, if that's going to be even more devastating. Like if there's one Civ that's just, you know, steamrolling and getting way ahead of all the others and triggers this early, like, is that going to be even more devastating for all those other Civs that are maybe not quite, you know, prepared to deal with that yet?
Well, if it is good, they win the era. Screw the other Civs, and they're not far behind. Better luck next era or age.
Okay, what's the next topic on the list?
Kenneth is up next, introducing something that's so old it's new.
Sorry, I'm getting business calls in the middle of this.
Unforgivable.
It's like Saturday. Why?
Tell them they have to wait.
No, because if I tell them they have to wait, then I have to wait for my dinner. So.
All right, well then tell them to bend over.
Okay, well in that case, I guess we'll go on and hopefully Canis can get that resolved and join us. So.
Nope, I'm here. I'm here. It's okay. Over.
All right.
So we want to talk about leaders now?
Yes.
Yes.
So we have this new situation. We're not going to talk about specific leaders yet. But leaders are now independently selected from civilizations, and they remain constant throughout the whole game, which I think makes sense because it would be really weird if you're playing a game where the civilization changes and the leader changes, and you're trying to figure out who the identity of the person you've been fighting for the whole game is.
Well, I think there were a lot of people, including myself, who were surprised that they're changing civilizations. I think a lot of players, including myself, expected that if they were going to do something like this, it would be you pick a civilization and then the leader changes throughout the course of the game. But they decided not to go with that instead. So,
well, it was a beach that was really big on the idea of the rise and fall of civilization. You know, you can trace Italy all the way back to the Roman Empire. How did they get from the Roman Empire to becoming Italy? You know, it's kind of
right.
They went through a holy period in there, but. You know.
Yes, but yeah, I mean, but it's a path. You start out, you could start out as Caesar and go into the Holy Roman Emperor type of thing and then become Italy.
And still be Caesar, which makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
But the idea is we have leaders that level up over time. So it's kind of like if you've ever played the Endless Legend or Endless Space games where you've got leaders that slowly, you get these leaders from places like the Academy and then they level up slowly. And in that game, they become city governors or generals, but in Civ, it seems more like they are becoming, or they are your just regular leader. You get six, there are six attributes you can learn skills in. You've got cultural, diplomatic, economic, expansionistic, militaristic, and scientific. You gain points throughout the game by doing various things. It's not clear exactly what these things are. Some of them have to do with following, I would assume, the legacy paths or doing well in crises or various things you do. Leaders do not change visually in the ages, which I think is kind of a missed opportunity. But
No bearskin Abraham Lincoln this time?
No, but it would be really nice if we could, maybe that could be a thing. Though I guess we do know that personas are back and various leader outfits are different personas, so
yeah. I saw one of the rewards. It was either a pre-order bonus or a bonus for signing up for the 2K thing. Is different skins for Napoleon.
Yeah.
So
having a 2K account gives you one of his skins, and then having a 2K account that you played in Civ 6 also gives you a skin.
Yeah.
But they're both of Napoleon. So
it would be cool if it's assuming every leader is going to have multiple skins or multiple personas or whatever they're calling it. It would be kind of cool if you could have at least the option to change that when you go into a new age, even if it's just cosmetic, like if it doesn't change their abilities or powers or whatever, even if it's just cosmetic, that would be kind of like a cool thing to like punctuate the fact that you're, you know, in a new age and things are different now.
And then the next thing we know about leaders is somehow, and we're not sure how, but hopefully it's not the way that I think it is, progression bonuses for your leaders accumulate across multiple gameplay sessions. Now, what I hope that doesn't mean is that every time you play a game of Civilization with a leader, it increases an EXP scale like something in like Overwatch. I don't want that kind of progression. But
oh, are you talking about like a cumulative progression thing where it's also saved between different like matches, different campaigns?
Yeah. Because that's what it sounds like they were talking about to me, but hopefully that's not what they are talking about. Maybe it's just I don't know. I guess I can't think of a good way that that would make me happy unless it's something in a different realm. But that is a thing that apparently is going on in this game.
Yeah, I wonder if, because this says it's a fact sheet, so it's some kind of, I'm looking at the Well of Souls thing, and it says it's a fact sheet, which is probably some kind of, PR publication thing. I'm wondering if what they're talking about is just that these accumulate over the different ages, right? And, like, so if you stop playing at the end of an age and then reload the game later with the new age, like, you keep whatever bonuses you'd accumulate. I also would hope that this is not, like, cumulative. Every time you play Civ, every time you play a new campaign, your leaders level up and keep those levels, because that seems like that would be unbalancing.
Yeah, but also,
Or maybe you could put the cosmetic stuff into this unlock progression. Like, you can get new outfits or new music as a result of leveling up your leader, while the gameplay stuff is not affected by it. That way, when you go into multiplayer or you play a lot of games, you're not just stronger because you played more.
Yeah, it's potentially problematic. That's the one thing, that's one of the main things that I worry about in the future of this game.
Yeah, and I don't remember anybody talking about that in any of the, like, preview videos or any of the content creator videos that I saw. And so I'm hoping that it's just, like, you know, a badly worded PR speak.
I'll give Firaxis
some credit here. I've never seen them implement something like that. I mean, I guess to an extent, the DLC civs, if you, like, play multiplayer with someone who has one and you don't, and you think that DLC civ is stronger, but, like, that's the closest thing we've had to, like, unbalanced stuff as a consequence of unlocks.
But they're still intended to be balanced with each other. Like, they're all supposed to be on an equal playing field. Yeah. Whether that functionally happens or not is different. But
what I'm saying. Firaxis hasn't done anything like, okay, you've unlocked stuff in single player, now you can go wreck people.
Right. And specifically
so they're probably not here too.
One of the other pre-order bonuses, I think, was like having, I think I saw like 5-day early access or something like that. So, like, yeah. Hypothetically, right, if you pre-order the game and you get the 5-day early access and you just grind for that 5 days and unlock all of the, you know, perks or whatever for all these leaders, like, are you hypothetically then able to go into a match with someone who then just bought the game on release day and now all of your leaders are just, like, way more powerful? Like, yeah, definitely hope that that's not how this works.
I wouldn't worry about that until we see something like that. Like,
for the record, if you want to play 5 days early, you have to spend at least $100 on Civ 7. Because that's something we haven't mentioned yet, but Civ 7 base edition is $70. The deluxe edition, which has one DLC pack in it, is $100. And the Founders edition is $130. And there's a lot of stuff mentioned in the list of stuff. Like, the Founders edition, which is the biggest one, includes a collection that's 2 new leaders, 4 new civilizations, 4 new wonders, a special cosmetic bonus, and other non-listed features. And then it also has another collection, which has 2 new leaders, 4 new civilizations, 4 new wonders, a cosmetic bonus, and also more stuff that's not listed. And then,
and I think Ed Beach also said that it'll simultaneously release on consoles, too.
Yes.
But although I don't recall if I saw a specific list of which consoles. So presumably that's PS5 and Xbox S or X. I don't know if that includes the Switch.
They said very specifically that it is all consoles, all the time, all at once. So everywhere the game is released, we'll get all its stuff all at the same time.
Well, right. But I mean, like, presumably there's not like a PS4 version, right? So I'm assuming this is only going to be on current gen consoles. And so I'm saying, I don't know if, like, the Switch counts as a current gen, you know,
that
console
was specifically
still. Or
mentioned as it, because somebody asked about Switch 2 and they didn't say anything about Switch 2. So,
well, yeah. Let's go to the Civilization 7 page on the official website, which is civilization.2k.com/civ-7 It lists the following. Oh, no, it's giving me the stupid social media crap instead of the thing that I actually want, which is the available locations. I guess if I turn on the. Hope you guys didn't hear that. Why don't I mute it? That makes it.
It lists
here Nintendo Switch, Xbox, PS4, PS5, Epic Game Store, Steam.
Wow, it is PS4.
Oh, it is coming out to some last gen consoles. Okay, well, there you go.
Well, to be honest, if you're going to make a game for the PS5, might as well make it for the PS4 as well, because PS5 has supply issues, and also a lot of people just didn't buy one. So, and it doesn't list like Series X or Series S or whatever the Xbox thing is.
I guess your min requirements on this game are not going to be too devastating if it can run on the PS4.
If it can run on the Switch.
That's true, too. Yeah, the Switch is even weaker.
The Switch is the weakest console by far.
Well, we also saw the console versions for Civ 6 also had limitations. Like, they had the lower player count and smaller map size and stuff like that. So we still also don't know if that sort of stuff is going to apply to the console versions for Civ 7. So,
presumably.
Yeah, I don't know how it couldn't. Unless they are just way better at optimization than they've ever been in the past.
Well, this is the first time they're doing the console content in-house, I think.
Yeah, presumably they don't have to, if it's all releasing at the same time, they don't have to outsource this to a third-party company.
Well, okay, but even their PC optimization has left something to be desired, to put it mildly, for the last, I don't know, 3+ Civ iterations? Maybe all of them?
It's so pretty good
it would
now.
Be a complete deviation of capability if in Civ 7, all of a sudden, they could do so well with optimization that they could put the same version on the Switch as they can on, like, a current PC and have it run pretty well similarly, that with good graphics at that. Like, if they can do that, that's like a complete turnaround.
Very true.
And while you're at it, make the UI good this time. I don't have much faith, considering we're delivering it to all these consoles, that they've given any regard for input efficiency this time, since they haven't in the last two Civs. But
have you seen,
I hope so,
any of the UI that they've shown?
I mean, it's one thing to look at the UI visually, but like, that's only a part of the UI experience.
Yeah,
and it's not the part I've had a problem with.
Yeah.
But it's also like game design things. I mean, like, how many cities are we going to have? Like, how much busy work is it going to be to go to all of them and check their production queues and, you know, stuff like that? Like, are we going to have 4 or 5 cities like in Civ 5, or are we going to have 20 cities like in Civ 6? Like, you know, stuff like
More
that.
More like Civ 5, because there, at least in the Antiquity Age, there was a settlement limit.
It's not a hard limit, though.
That might not be there in later eras. And
yes,
like, even in Civ 5, the UI slowing the game down was very significant in terms of input efficiency, to the point of being frustrating. That was especially true with units, but it was there with cities too. It was much harder and slower to manage an individual city in 5 than it was in 4.
Well, we'll get to units later, but that definitely looks like it will at least be easier to manage.
Yeah, there's been some design improvements there, but I still want to see control improvements, because the control in Civ 5 and 6 were pretty bad. Compared to the rest of the game. And so I would love to see that improved, but
well, and especially
thinking about the Switch and stuff, I don't have much faith. On the other hand, you would think that good controls would help with playing the game on these systems. So, you know, who knows?
Yeah, and especially with Civ 5 or Civ 6 Vanilla, which like didn't even have a production queue yet. Like we didn't get that until, was that the second expansion that gave us the production queue or the first one?
I don't remember.
We also didn't have like hotkeys for it. We didn't have consistent input buffering, which was miserable when playing in multiplayer with you guys. Where like I'd give a unit an order and then like it wouldn't do it. Like, and I'd click on the next unit and it wouldn't count that I clicked on the next unit, except for sometimes it would count that I clicked on the next unit. So like I'd have to wait extra time on a timer to confirm that my orders counted, because only sometimes did they count. And there's no like observable consistency between that, between the network and the computer itself. I had to wait. Even in single player, I had to wait, though. Like, that kind of stuff gets annoying. Now, if you play really slowly, it doesn't. So, like, this is only a problem for some players, but it is a problem. It is a mark against the game. It doesn't mean the game is necessarily bad, but it is a mark against the game if you're trying to play it and it interferes with you being able to. Anyway, moving on. I'm not saying anything new here. I'm just hoping that with the new game, we get new solutions.
So civics, we still have that as a tree, and it's like with the tech tree, it's only this far into it. But also, each civ is going to have its own specific little mini civics tree. And I think I'm assuming at this point you're going to have a little, it extends in each age. But like in the footage they had, they showed that with Egypt, that you had sort of, it's almost like a pantheon for Egypt, at least, because it was referring to some of the Egyptian gods. But
it's like three civics.
Yeah, it's like three. It's a short tree, but it looks like they had some good bonuses in it. So I think
they were pretty full. I mean, there were like 5 icons on like all of the the text in Civ 6. So it like a problem in Civ 5 and Civ 6, especially early on when the games like first released, is there were a lot of like technologies and stuff in the tech tree that would unlock like one or two things, and it was like, eh, it doesn't seem all that great. But like everything I've seen for this one so far, like it looks like there are a lot of things are being and if they're and they, I think they even specifically said like that they improved the civics and made it so that the civics give you more things. So, you know, because in a common complaint in Civ 6 was the civics basically just unlocked policy cards, but like you wouldn't use all those policy cards. So most of the civics you would unlock, you just it wasn't a big deal, right? It wasn't like unlocking a new technology. Now you've got a new unit. And it's like, oh, I must build that new unit now. It was just like, oh, whatever. Maybe sometime down the road I will use that policy card, but probably not.
You do have to watch for power creep with something like this. That said, I like that each civ will become more unique as a consequence of this.
And you can steer it also a little bit more because both the techs and the civics have, they didn't explain how this was going to work, but you can like reinvest into a tech or a civic for a mastery in it. So, what did we see it under? Like, I think on one of them, not agriculture, but what comes after that, like irrigation and something.
Writing like and masonry were the first techs that have it. And then pretty much everything in the tiers after that have it.
Yeah. So you can like double down in the writing and maybe go harder into science, or if you wanted stronger walls early, you could double down into masonry. I don't know.
Something that Beyond Earth did.
We know almost nothing about this.
Yeah. It was just I remembered that, and it's like, since we're talking about that, hey, that was in there too. Because it was also the civics, so you could be more civilized, I guess.
It's actually like six topics down the list of things we're talking about, but it's also your topic, so I'll let it go.
Well, it is part of civics, because we have to point out that that is a possibility for civics.
Yeah.
And that we have our little unique tree, so, you know, your civ is going to be not just... I do like that, because it means we're not always following exactly the same path through civics trees, because it feels like that sometimes now in the Civ 6 games. Is like, do this.
Well, a lot of Civ 6, it's beeline to the governments, right? And yes. Screw everything else, because very few of the other civics have things that are super useful. There's a handful that are like really critical that you want to go for early, but most of them are just like, no, I don't care. I just need to get to the next government.
Or have something that's attached to guilds, and I want to beeline that. Yeah.
The early game civics tree is the only part that I really focus a lot on a specific tech order, because in Civ 6, I mean, because it gives you your first government, it gives you the government district, and it gives you the settler increasing abilities that are really important for getting
fast. Yeah, and all the upgrades for like builders and stuff, the policies that give them extra charges or whatever.
I mean, your order in the early game is more likely to be similar between games, because like expanding and protecting yourself in the early turns is always useful.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it looks like the new civics thing gives us more opportunity to steer the civ in a certain direction.
Yeah.
Since we don't have a bunch of specific ones to talk about and what they do, that's civics right now. That's what we know.
It's pretty much what we know.
This is where we get into the 10-turn bonus with the governments, too.
Oh, yeah, that's also part of that topic, but it's a separate category. So basically what we know about governments is that they give, like, for instance, we know Classical Republic gives plus 20% culture for 10 turns and plus 15% towards constructing wonders for 10 turns. And
these are only for celebrations, though.
Yeah, this comes from celebrations, which are tied to
happiness, which is your version of the having your amenities and stuff right now.
It seems like it's a return to Civ 5 happiness, kind of, but there's local happiness and non-local happiness. I don't know, maybe it's the same system as Civ 5, but better described, because I know local happiness was a thing in Civ 5, but it was never described as its own thing.
I think it had to be like patched into the game after the fact, too, because I don't think vanilla had that division between local and global.
I think it was a DLC add-on. I think it was Gods and Kings that did that.
I think it was earlier than that. I think it was one of the patches, but it was not there for vanilla release.
It's possible.
As long as we avoid attaching happiness to city count like we did in 5, it should be fine. Without that, you really can have a local system that just simply scales into a global rating.
Well, even the way apparently you're going to be building cities is different too, but we're going to talk about that more later. So.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, that's going to look different to any Civ game in the past.
So, yeah, I don't know if those old rules even necessarily would apply.
I think they do.
Well, those old rules, if they existed, would be impactful because it's screwed with so many things.
Yeah, something...
Your penalties for being at low global happiness or unhappiness were... They were awful. They were so awful that people stayed small to avoid that.
Let's finish up the governments real quick. We have despotism, which gives 20% science and 30% infantry unit training for 10 turns each. And then oligarchy, which is 20% food and 20% construction for buildings for 10 turns. So,
and it does say that is achieved by filling it locally. So it is really that one city does that for not your, you're not getting a global bonus, but that one city, of course, in antiquity, probably is really your capital, is going to do that. So you could speed, if you knew it was coming, you could see your happiness was almost full up, then you could get something started. Like you could get that wonder started and then you could like push really hard to finish it or deliberately use the trade routes and stuff to make your whatever city that is happy really fast because you need it to build up, you know.
That's interesting because the oligarchy bonuses that give you food or would be a lot more attractive outside your capital by the time you can probably unlock them. So there might be like some tethered gameplay implications of your government choice and what you're doing in the early age that gets
you. Talk of what you could do with trade routes gives me the idea you probably could do that. You could do the trade route to the other city and push its food to make it grow faster.
Yeah, if that's allowed in antiquity, then yeah, that would be...
That would be the most important time for it to be allowed, I think.
Did anyone even see if like trade routes are even in the game this time?
I don't know. Oh, yeah. They definitely are.
That you move manually for it.
The thing is the Potato McWhiskey and Spiffing Brit, when they were having their little thing, they were talking about that they got up to shenanigans with trade routes.
Yeah, like pretty much every Civ game in recent memory, like since 4, has had a period of time where trade routes are busted in one way or another.
I don't know if Civ 6 had that, but...
Trade routes were OP in real life too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't know. They're still really strong in 6.
They're definitely strong in 6, but they're not broken because the game is designed around it.
Yeah, that's
they've
true.
Been balanced. Whereas there's things right now in this early build that it's definitely a little broken in some things.
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't call them broken, but they're so impactful that you want to get there very quickly.
There's a reason
that's true
why,
for a few other things too, but
there's a reason why in my Civ games, if it's not a coastal city, it has a commercial district.
Any OP, please nerf.
Yeah, I don't use that as a hard and fast rule, but I guess that is true for a huge percentage of my cities. They're either coastal or they wind up with a commercial as one of theirs.
So our next thing is diplomacy.
Oh boy. Here I have a mixed bag on it.
Well, I think it's kind of exciting because it looks like they are at least trying a lot of new things and also bringing some of the things back from Beyond Earth that we've been telling them to bring back for a long time. So,
yeah
I like some of the concepts.
Yeah, it's whether or not it's going to work in execution.
Yeah, especially concerning to me is using influence for quote-unquote negative actions like the sanctioning a civ or like immediately causing trouble for nations at war. So like, without actually going to war or having consequences or risk for it, tons of nations could all dogpile on one nation to like screw with their military and like make them super unhappy. And like, what's the counterplay for that?
Yeah, I think I do explicitly remember some of the content creators though, like Spiffing Brit or Potato McWhiskey or someone saying that they liked that. So maybe it does work pretty well. I also think I remember seeing at one point there was a screenshot that showed that trying to declare a surprise war costs influence. It was like a sizable number. I think it was like 150 influence or something like
that. Yeah, and you know where that goes? So, it goes to the other civ.
Yeah.
It goes to the one you declared on, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So that's interesting because I'm wondering if maybe that means like you have to spend influence to declare a surprise war, but does that mean then that there are like casus belli that allow you to declare war without having to spend that influence or at a significant discount?
Probably.
So hopefully that means there will just be less like, you know, AI leaders just declaring war on people on a whim because it actually costs a resource that they have to manage now.
Well, what it seems
like... one of those systems that in many games has caused problems when you have... Because it's an asymmetric system. EU4 had this with its espionage system for a while until they, like, gutted it and then completely worked their espionage idea group into something that is like a shell. All of those bonuses are, like, useful outside of espionage except for, like, a couple of them. They really, like... they gutted their espionage aspect of the game so much that they had to like change an idea group to give you tangible non-espionage bonuses all over the place. Because if you didn't do that, it was allowing like little tiny nations all over the place to gang up using the espionage mechanic on one nation and basically screw it over pretty fiercely for a little bit there.
Yeah, I remember those days.
And I have concerns that we're going to get something like that again, where you know, everyone's generating influence and they're like, all right, well, this one nation, we're just going to hose them, like literally hose them, like get out a hose and just spray them from like six directions. So and how do you invest to stop this? Ah, lol, you can't.
In defense of that game design philosophy, though, I think that is infinitely preferable to just having like arbitrary rubber banding mechanics going on. Like, if you want there to be ways for players who are behind to catch up, I think that, you know, encouraging smaller powers to, you know, share resources and gang up on the more powerful powers is a better way of doing that than just saying, you're too big, now you have a bunch of corruption penalties or whatever, like what was in like Civ 3 and Civ 4.
Now, wait a minute here. We're not just encouraging. We are giving them a system whereby they can, with very minimal investment, screw the larger nation. If it was just them banding together, that's different.
Right, but again, maybe that then puts more pressure on the larger empires to, you know, maintain more peaceful or amicable relations with those smaller powers. Like, if you are just being completely belligerent throughout the entire game, well, now there's going to be...
Well, everybody is going to dogpile on you.
Yeah, there's going to be significant consequences for that. Whereas in previous games...
They dogpile on you with their actual resources.
Like, sure, Jesus. But like in previous games...
What you're saying, the risk of this is basically creating an environment where it is indistinguishable from like those corruption systems.
Hello?
It's like that corruption system with a couple extra steps, basically.
Sorry, I have a toddler climbing on me right now.
Unless you have some kind of counterplay or way to invest against this like screwing you over, that's costly.
I still think it's different than like the corruption mechanics, because the corruption mechanic was a penalty that the game applied to the player for being too big or too powerful. Whereas this is something that other players are applying to one player. So I think it is fundamentally
different.
Yeah,
the game is handing on them out the ability to do so without them taking any specific action. In other words, it's the corruption system with extra steps. Unless there's more nuance to this that we just haven't seen yet.
Yeah,
like, I don't want to say this is bad without knowing the full system, which we don't right now.
It
might
like
be fine,
earning...
but it's a point of concern for me because I've seen this in more than one game where it's just a problem. And also, this could instead be a catch-up mechanic. Like, you can use influence, like, with other civs to kind of tangible benefit to the civs with the influence. That's a little less bad, because now the big nation can play around it, and the smaller nations can choose how they invest this influence in a way that benefits them optimally.
Now you
have counterplay.
Yeah, I mean, we won't really know until we figure out things like, how is the influence generated? Like, does it come from infrastructure? Does it come from other... Go ahead.
You could see up in the top corner that it was one of the things at the top, like your science, your gold, it is something you're going to generate. So there's got to be some, you're probably initially generating from the palace.
Yeah. Does it come from buildings and districts? Does it come from your interactions with independent civilizations? Or does it come from governments and civics?
It seemed like it was a basic resource type of a thing.
Is it something that comes off of the map? I mean, who knows?
I don't know. Well, if you run into some of the Goody Hut type areas, maybe you get some bonus influence that way.
But it could also be something where maybe things like having peaceful relationships and having treaties and having trade routes with other civilizations, stuff like that, like maybe that is the primary way of accumulating influence, right? In which case that is just diplomatic play. And if you're neglecting that, then you have very little influence and you are going to be more at the mercy of the other players who are playing diplomatically, whether they're big, massive, sprawling empires or, you know, smaller empires that are just, you know, grouping together and using their collective political will to, you know, try to smack you down.
Again, though, this can create an environment where just because one player is starting to do well, the other nations decide to break off relations with that player. And even though they haven't actually done anything aggro or necessarily bad, they are now in a situation where everyone else can generate influence and they can't, and they can now use this influence to screw with their happiness.
Well, okay,
and what's their countermeasure for this beyond declaring war, giving their opponents more influence to do this crap even more. Like, it doesn't have to be implemented that way. It might not be like that, but there is a real danger here with how this could be implemented based on what I'm seeing, where it could result in trouble. Where it can result in, like, screwing someone without them being able to really do anything about it.
Well, and okay, until we have more details on where we're getting the influence from, it's hard to say good, bad, or not.
I just have some concerns because of the negative actions, and I don't know fully how the influence is being generated and distributed. Like, maybe you can generate enough influence to resist this, or to, like, do positive actions in your own empire to counteract other nations doing negative actions on you. And, you know, as long as you're generating enough influence, maybe you can offset that, and there is some counterplay. It might be okay.
We did see in part of the footage that they were being able to negotiate, like, what was it? It was like a cultural exchange type of thing where both parties benefited from it. Like, one party proposed it, and you had to spend a lot to not get it with them, but you could also invest in it so that you were both getting bonuses. Yeah. And at least on a human player, they're going to see the point in keeping that going. And depending on how they've programmed the AI, maybe the AI recognizes, I have this. It's giving me a bonus. Is it worth what I'm going? Is the AI going to be able to properly weigh? Is it worth what I would gain to go to war with them to not, and then have everybody else? I don't know. Is the AI going to be able to realize that if I declare on this one person and screw this up, it's going to make everybody dogpile on me?
And it would also be really nice to have, you know, cooperation mechanics like that that do not require, like, formally declared friendships and alliances and stuff like that. Because in Civ 6, we had those formal alliances, and you had one of each type, and that limited the number of Civs that you can ally with. But also it meant that, like, the only way that you had that ludic, you know, incentive to not backstab or declare war on someone was because you had already spent a bunch of time and effort and resources building up that relationship. Whereas if this is something that you can do with, you know, neutral relationships, and you can create these sort of mutually beneficial agreements, then that would be something that I think would be really cool, because that is then a deterrent to just, you know, arbitrarily or whimsically declaring war on players, because, you know, you are getting benefit from them, and it didn't require that, oh, you're already, like, allied or whatever.
Yeah, it didn't seem like it was a formal alliance thing. It's like, if you were on, definitely it was easier to get implemented if you were at friendly relations, at least. But maybe there's still a possibility of it happening at neutral. I mean, we don't know. This is one of the systems that we don't have as much detail as we'd like.
I'll go so far as to say, like, arrangements like that, where you have mutually beneficial exchanges between civs, are strictly good for the game, both from a historical and from a game incentive perspective. What I don't like is just the combination of the ability to deny this to a particular civ, no matter what they do, and then also generating a resource that is exclusively generated this way that can then be used to screw that target civ over. Because that creates a unique situation where, unlike any other mechanical interaction in the game, you're basically able to deny somebody a resource and, like, cause them grief without them having any means to secure a resource to resist that griefing. But maybe you can. Maybe you can locally generate influence to some degree.
I also want to point out that, you know, we have said many times in the past that we liked the diplomatic influence mechanic that was in Beyond Earth's expansion pack. So, you know, like, I would like to give them the benefit of the doubt and think that if they're, you know, if they're revisiting that and iterating on that, then hopefully it will work at least as well. But, you know, again, we won't know until we, you know, get more information or have the game in our hands.
Yeah. I mean, the devil's in the details here, so we'll see.
Yeah, how it is.
Yeah. And again, I think the biggest question mark is, where does this resource come from?
Insufficient data to proceed.
Yeah. So, I guess, thank you for joining us on podcast episode 438. It's been the me and team, joined by Canis Albinus.
Yay! We're going to have to do a second parter for this, aren't we?
Whee! Makalua?
So much, I can't watch all the things. Too many people putting out things.
And Mega Bears fan.
Yep, totally still here.
Go Vikings.
Ah!
Betrayal. So the Vikings aren't going to be good next year. Their starting quarterback got wrecked and is out for the season. Or no, I guess it's their backup, who was looking like he was playing well enough to be their starter. The guy they just drafted. And now they have to use, like, some trash can they picked up from another team, so.
Oh no.
Yeah, the Vikings are going to be bad. I don't think he's worried about them.
Civilization 3, 4, 5, Beyond Earth, 6, and 7 sound clips. Copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright The Polycast at thepolycast.net.